Track 6.
I think all of us were coming to regard the pool at Gunfire Break with a superstitious dread. The series of accidents and mishaps to which we'd been subject appeared to be the result of some deliberate, malevolent scheme. It seemed as though each time we returned to the pool, it had grown more sinister in its aspect, and that an aura of menace was growing about it. "You know what I think," Sherry said laughingly, but not completely as a joke. "I think the spirits of the murdered Mogul princes have followed the treasure to act as guardians." Even in the bright sunshine of a glorious morning, I saw the expression on the faces of Angelo and Chubby. "I think the spirits were in those two big Johnny Uptails that we killed yesterday." Chubby looked as though he had breakfasted off a dozen rotten oysters. He blanched to a waxy golden brown, and I saw him make the sign with his right hand. "Miss Sherry," said Angelo severely, "you must never talk like that." I could see goose flesh on his forearms. Both he and Chubby had an attack of the ghostlies. "Yes, cut it out," I agreed.
"I was joking," protested Sherry.
"Oh, good joke," I said. "You really slayed us." And we were all silent during the passage of the channel and until we'd taken station in the shelter of the reef. I was sitting in the bows, and when all three of them looked at me, I saw by the expression on their faces that I had a crisis of morale on my hands. "I'll go down alone," I announced, and there was a small stir of relief.
"I'll go with you,"
Sherry volunteered half-heartedly. "Later," I agreed. "But first I want to check for Johnny's, and recover the equipment we lost yesterday." I went down cautiously, hanging just under the boat for 5 minutes while I scrutinized the depth of the pool for those evil dark shapes, and then finning down quietly. It was cold and eerie in the deeper shades, but I saw that the night tide had scarred the pool and sucked out to sea all the carrion and blood that had attracted the shark pack the previous day. There was no sign of the huge white death carcasses, and the only fish I saw were the multitudinous shoals of brilliant coral dwellers. A glint of silver from below led me to the spear I'd abandoned in my rush for the boat, and I found the empty scubas and the damaged demand valve where we'd left them in the gunport. I surfaced with my load, and there were smiles amongst my crew for the first time that day when I reported the pool clear. "All right," I capitalized on the rise of their spirits. "Today we're going to open up the hold."
"Are you going in through the hull?"
Chubby asked. "I thought about that, Chubby, but I reckoned that it would need a couple of heavy charges to get in that way. No, I've decided to go in through the passenger deck into the well." I sketched it on my slate for them, as I explained. "The cargo will have shifted. It'll be lying in a jumble just beyond that bulkhead, and once we pop her open here, we can drag it out item by item into the companionway."
"It's a long haul from there to the gunport."
Chubby lifted his cap and massaged his bald dome thoughtfully. "I'll rig a light block and tackle at the gun deck ladder and another at the gunboat."
"A lot of work."
Chubby looked sad.
"The first time you agree with me, I'm going to begin worrying that I may be wrong."
"I didn't say you were wrong," said Chubby stiffly.
"I just said it was a lot of work. You can't let Miss Sherry haul on a block and tackle, can you now?"
"No," I agreed. "No, we need somebody with beef." And I prodded his bulging, rock-hard gut.
"That's what I thought," said Chubby mournfully. "You want me to get geared up?"
"No," I stopped him. "Sherry can come down with me to set the charges now. I wanted her to test her nerves after the previous day's horrors. We'll blast the well open and then go home. We aren't going to work again immediately after blasting. We're going to let the tide clean the pool of dead fish before going down. I don't want an action replay of yesterday." We crept in through the gunport and followed the nylon guideline we had placed on our first visit along the gun deck, up through the companion ladder to the passenger deck, and then along the dark, forbidding tunnel to the dead-end bulkhead of the forward well. While Sherry held the torch for me, I began to drill a hole through the partition with the brace and bit that I'd brought from the surface. It was awkward working without a really firm stance on which to anchor myself, but the first inch and a half was easy going. this layer of wood had rotted to a soft, corky consistency. But beyond that I encountered iron-hard oak planking, and I had to abandon my efforts. I'd have been a week at the task. Unable to place my explosive in prepared shot holes, I would now have to use a larger charge than I really wanted, and rely on the tunnel effects of the passageway for a secondary shock to drive the panel inwards. I used 6 half-sticks of gelignite, placed on the corners and in the centre of the bulkhead, and I secured them to bolts driven into the woodwork with a slap hammer. It took almost half an hour to set up the blast, and afterwards it was a relief to leave the claustrophobic confines of the ancient hull and to rise up through clean, clear water to the silver surface, trailing the insulated wires behind us. Chubby fired the shots while we stripped off our equipment. The shock was cushioned by the hull of the wreck, so it was hardly noticeable to us on the surface. We left the pool immediately afterwards and ran home with rising spirits to the prospects of a lazy day while we waited the tide to clean the pool of carrion. In the afternoon, Sherry and I went on a picnic down to the south tip of the island. For provisions, we took a wicker-covered 2-litre bottle of Portuguese Vinhos Verde, but to supplement this, we dug out a batch of big sand clams, which I wrapped in seaweed and rebedded in the sand. Over them, I built an open fire of driftwood. By the time we'd almost finished the wine, the sun was setting and the clams were ready to eat. The wine and the food and the glorious sunset had a softening effect on Sherry North. She became doe-eyed and melting, and when the sunset faded at last and made way for a fat yellow lover's moon, we walked home barefooted on the wet sand. The next morning, Chubby and I worked for half an hour bringing down the equipment we needed from the whaleboat and stacking it on the gun deck of the wreck before we were able to penetrate deeper into the hull. The heavy charges I'd set against the well had wrought the sort of havoc I feared. They had torn out the decking and smashed in the bulkheads of the passenger cabins, blocking the passage for a quarter of its length. We found a good anchor point for our block and tackle, and while Chubby rigged it, I left him and floated back to the nearest cabin. I played my torch through the shattered panelling. The interior was, like everything else, smothered in a thick furring of marine growth, but I could make out the shape of the simple furniture beneath it. I eased myself through the gap and moved slowly across the cluttered deck, fascinated by the objects which I found scattered and heaped about the cabin. There were items of porcelain and china, a shattered washbasin, and a magnificent chamber pot with a pink floral design showing through the film of accumulated sediment. There were cosmetic pots and scent bottles, smaller, indefinable metal objects, and mounds of rotted and amorphous material, which may have been clothing, curtaining, or mattresses and bedclothing. I glanced at my watch and saw that it was time to leave, and surface for a change of air bottles. As I turned, a small square object caught my attention, and I played the torch beam upon it while I gently brushed it clear of the thick layer of muddy filth. But the lid was beautifully inlaid with mother-of-pearl and tortoiseshell. I picked it up and tucked it under my arm. Chubby had finished rigging the block and tackle, and he was waiting for me beside the gun-deck ladder. When we surfaced beside the whaleboat, I passed the box up to Angela before climbing aboard. While Sherry poured coffee for us, and Angelo charged the demand valve to the fresh scuba bottles, I lit a cheroot and examined the box. It was in a sorry state of deterioration, I saw at once. The inlay was rotten and falling out of its seating, the rosewood was swollen and distorted, and the lock and hinges half eaten away. Sherry came to sit beside me on the thwart and examined my prize with me. She recognized it immediately. "It's a lady's jewel box," she exclaimed. "Open it, Harry. Let's see what's inside." I slipped the blade of a screwdriver under the lock, and at the first pressure the hinges snapped and the lid flew off. "Oh, Harry!" Sherry was first into it, and she came out with a thick gold chain and a heavy locket of the same material. "This stuff is so in fashion, you'd never believe it." Everyone was dipping into the box now. Angelo ripped off a pair of gold and sapphire earrings, which immediately replaced the brass pair he habitually wore, while Chubby picked an enormous necklace of garnets, which he hung round his neck and preened like a teenage girl. "For my missus," he explained. It was the personal jewellery of a middle-class wife, probably some minor official or civil servant. None of it of great value, but its context, it was a fascinating collection. Inevitably, Miss North acquired the lion's share, but I managed to snatch away a thick, plain, gold wedding band. "What do you want with that?" she challenged me, reluctant to yield a single item. "Oh, I'll find a use for it," I told her, and gave her one of my looks of deep significance, which was completely wasted, for she'd returned to ransacking the jewel box. Nevertheless, I tucked the ring safely away in the small zip pocket of my canvas gear bag. Chubby, by this stage, was bedecked with chunky jewellery like a Hindu bride. "My God, Chubby, you're a dead ringer for Liz Taylor," I told him, and he accepted the compliment with a graceful inclination of his head. I had a difficult job getting him interested in a return to the wreck, but once we were in the passenger deck again, he worked like a giant amongst the shattered wreckage. We hauled out the panelling and timber baulks that blocked the passage by use of the block and tackle and our combined strength, and we dragged it down to the gun deck and stacked it out of the way in the recesses of that gloomy gallery. We had reached the well of the forward hold by the time our air supplies were almost exhausted. The heavy planking had broken up in the explosion, and beyond the opening we could make out what appeared to be a solid dark mass of material. I guessed that this was a conglomerate formed by the cargo out of its own weight and pressure. However, it was afternoon the following day before I found that I was correct. We were at last into the hold, but I had not expected such a Herculean task as awaited us there. The contents of the hold had been impregnated with seawater for over a century. 90% of the containers had rotted and collapsed, and the perishable contents had coalesced into a friable dark mass. Within this solid heap of marine compost, the metal objects, the containers of stronger and impervious material, and other imperishable objects, both large and small, were studded like lucky coins in a Christmas pudding. We'd have to dig for them. At this point, we encountered our next problem. At the slightest disturbance of this rotted mass, the water was immediately filled with a swirling storm of dark particles that blotted out the beams of the torches and plunged us into clouds of blinding darkness. We were forced to work by sense of touch alone. It was painfully slow progress. When we encountered some solid body in the softness, we had to drag it clear, manoeuvre it down the passage, lower it to the gun deck, and there try to identify it. Sometimes we were obliged to break open what remained of the container to get at the contents. If they were of little value or interest, we tucked them away in the depth of the gun deck to keep our working field clear. At the end of the first day's work, we had salvaged only one item which we decided was worth raising. It was a sturdy case of hard wood, covered with what appeared to be leather and with the corners bound in heavy brass. It was the size of a large cabin trunk. It was so heavy that Chubby and I couldn't lift it between us. The weight alone gave me high hopes. I believed it could very readily contain part of the Golden Throne. Although the container did not look like one that had been manufactured by an Indian village carpenter and his sons in the middle of the 19th century, yet there was a chance that the throne had been repacked before it was shipped from Bombay. If it did contain part of the throne, then our task would be simplified. We would know what type of container to look for in the future. Using the block and tackle, Chubby and I dragged the case down the gun deck to the gunport, and there we shrouded it in a nylon cargo net to prevent it bursting open or breaking during the ascent. To the eyes spliced into the circumference of the net, we attached the canvas flotation bags and inflated them from our air bottles. We went up with the case, controlling its ascent by either spilling air from the bags or adding more from our bottles. We came out beside the whaleboat, and Angelo passed us half a dozen nylon slings with which we secured the case before climbing aboard. The weight of the case defeated our efforts to lift it over the side, but the whaleboat heeled dangerously when the three of us made the attempt. We had to step the mast and use it as a derrick, and only then did our combined efforts suffice, and the case swung on board, spouting water from its seams. The moment that it sank to the deck, Chubby scrambled back to the motors and ran for the channel. The tide pressed closely on our heels as we went. The case was too weighty and our curiosity too strong to allow us to carry it up to the caves. We opened it on the beach, prising the lid open with a pair of jenny bars. The elaborate locking device in the lid was of brass and had withstood the ravages of salt sea water. It resisted our efforts bravely, but at last, with a rending of woodwork, the lid flew back and creaked against the heavily corroded hinges. My disappointment was immediate, for it was clear that this was no tiger throne. It was only when Sherry lifted out one of the large gleaming discs and turned it curiously in her hand that I began to suspect that we'd been awarded an enormous bonus. It was an entree plate she held, and my first thought was that it was of solid gold. However, when I snatched its mate from its slot in the cunningly designed rack and turned it to examine the hallmarks, I realized that it was silver and gold gilt. The gold plating had protected it from the sea so that it was perfectly preserved, a masterpiece of the silversmith's art, with a raised coat of arms in the center and the rim wondrously chased with scenes of wood and deer, of huntsmen and birds. The plate I held weighed almost 2 pounds, and as I set it aside and examined the rest of the set, I saw the weight of the chest fully accounted for. There were servings for 36 guests in the set: soup, bowls, fish plates, entree plates, dessert bowls, side plates, and all the cutlery to go with it. There were serving dishes, a magnificent chafing dish, wine coolers, dish covers, and a carving dish almost the size of a baby's bath. Every piece was wrought with the same coat of arms, and the ornamental scenes of wild animals and huntsmen, and the case had been designed to hold this array of plate. "Ladies and gentlemen," I said, "as your chairman, it behoves me to assure you one and all that our little venture is now in profit." "It's just plates and things," said Angelo, and I winced theatrically. "My dear Angelo, this is probably one of the few complete sets of Georgian banquet silverware remaining anywhere in the world. It's priceless." "How much?" asked Chubby doubtfully. "Good Lord, I don't know. It would depend, of course, on the maker and the original owner. This coat of arms probably belongs to some noble house, a wealthy nobleman on service in India, an earl, a duke perhaps, or even a viceroy." Chubby looked at me as though I was trying to sell him a spavined horse. "How much?" he repeated. "At Sotheby's, on a good day," I hesitated, "I don't know, say, £100,000. Chubby spat into the sand and shook his head. You couldn't fool old Chubby. "This fellow, Sotheby, does he run a loony house?"
"No, it's true, Chubby," Sherry cut in. "This stuff is worth a fortune. It could be much more than that."
Chubby was now torn between natural scepticism and chivalry. It would be an ungentlemanly act to call Sherry a liar. He compromised by lifting his hat and rubbing his head, spitting once more and saying nothing. However, he handled the case with new respect when we dragged it through the palms to the caves. We stored it behind the stack of jerrycans, and I went to fetch a new bottle of whiskey. "Even if there is no tiger thrown in the wreck, we aren't going to do too badly out of this," I told him. Chubby sipped at his whiskey mug and muttered, "100,000. They got to be crazy." "We've got to go through that hold and the cabins more carefully. We're going to leave a fortune down there if we don't." "Even the little items, less spectacular than the silver plate, they have enormous antique value," Sherry agreed.
"Trouble is, when you touch anything down there, it stirs up such a fog you can't see the tip of your nose," gloomed Chubby. And I refilled his mug with good cheer. "Listen, Chubby, you know that centrifugal water pump that Arnie Andrews had got out at Monkey Bay?" I asked, and Tubby nodded. "Will he lend it to us?" Arnie was Chubby's uncle. He owned a small market garden on the southern slopes of St. Mary's Island.
"He might," said Chubby warily. "Why?"
"Well, I want to try and rig a dredge pump," I explained, and sketched it for them in the sand between my feet. "We set the pump up in the whaleboat, and we use a length of steam hose to reach the wreck, like this," and I roughed it out with my finger. "Then we use it like a vacuum cleaner in the hold. Suck out all that muck and pump it to the surface."
"Eh, that's right," Angelo burst out enthusiastically. When it spills out the pump, we run it through a sieve, and we'll be able to pick up all the small stuff.
That's right. Only muck and small light items will go up the spout. Anything large or heavy will be left behind.
We discussed it for an hour, working out details and refinements on the basic idea. During that time, Chubby tried manfully to show no signs of enthusiasm. But finally, he could contain himself no longer.
"It might work," he muttered, which from him was a high accolade.
"Well, you better go and fetch that pump, hadn't you?" I said.
"I think I will have one more drink,"
he procrastinated, and I handed him the bottle.
"Take it with you," I suggested. "It'll save time."
He grunted and went to fetch his overcoat.
Sherry and I slept late, gloating on the lazy day ahead and at the feeling of having the island entirely to ourselves. We didn't expect Chubby and Angelo to return before noon. After breakfast, we crossed the saddle between the hills and went down to the beach. We were playing in the shallows, and the rumble of the surf on the outer reef and our own splashing and laughter blanketed any other sounds. It was only by chance that I looked up and saw the light aircraft sweeping in from the landward channel.
"Run! Run!" I shouted at Cherry, and she thought I was joking, until I pointed urgently at the approaching aircraft.
"Run! Don't let him see us!"
And this time she responded quickly. We floundered naked from the water and went up the beach at the top of our speed. Now I could hear the buzz of the aircraft engines, and I glanced over my shoulder. It was banking low over the southernmost peak of the island and levelling over the long, straight beach towards us.
"Faster! Faster!" I yelled at Sherry,
as she ran long-legged and full-bottomed ahead of me, with the wet tresses of her sable hair dangling down her darkly tan back. I looked back, and the aircraft was headed directly at us, still about a mile distance. But I could see that it was twin-engined. As I watched, it sank lower towards the snowy expanse of coral sands. We snatched up our discarded clothing at full run and sprinted the last few yards into the palm grove. There was a mound formed by a fallen palm tree and the fronds torn off the trees by the storm. It made a convenient shelter, and I grabbed Sherry's arm and dragged her down. We rolled under the shelter of the dead fronds and lay side by side, panting wildly, from the run up the beach. I saw now that it was a twin-engine Cessna. It came down the beach and swept past our hideaway, only 20 feet above the water's edge. The fuselage was painted a distinctive daisy yellow and was blazoned with the name Africair. I recognized the aircraft. I'd seen it before at St. Mary's Airport on half a dozen occasions, usually discharging or picking up groups of wealthy tourists. I knew that Africair was a charter company based on the mainland, and that its aircraft were for hire on a mileage tariff. I wondered who was paying for the hire on this trip. There were two persons in the forward seats of the aircraft, the pilot and the passenger, and their faces were turned towards us as it roared past. However, they were too far from us to make out the features, and I couldn't be sure if I knew either of them. They were both white men. That was all that was certain. The Cessna turned steeply out over the lagoon, and one wing pointed directly down into the crystal water. It swept around and levelled for another run down the beach. This time it passed so closely that for an instant I looked up into the face of the passenger as he peered down into the palm grove. I thought I recognised him, but I couldn't be certain. The Cessna then turned away, rising slowly, and set a new course for the mainland. There was something about her going that was complacent, the air of someone having achieved his purpose, a job well done. Sherry and I crawled from our hiding place and stood up to brush the sand from our damp bodies.
"Do you think they saw us?"
she asked timidly. "With that bottom of yours flashing like a mirror in the sunlight, they could hardly miss."
"Well, they might have mistaken us for a couple of native fishermen."
I looked at her, not at her face, and I grinned.
"Fisherman, with those great beautiful boobs?"
"Harry Fletcher, you're a disgusting beast," she said.
"But seriously, Harry, what's going to happen now?"
"I wish I knew, my dear. I wish I knew," I answered. But I was glad that Chubby had taken the case of silverware back to St. Mary's with him.
By now it was probably buried behind the shack at Turtle Bay. We were still in profit, even if we had to run for it soon. The visit by the aircraft instilled in us all a new sense of urgency. We knew now that our time was strictly rationed, and Chubby brought news with him when he returned that was equally disturbing. The Mandrake cruised for 5 days in the South Islands. They saw her nearly every day from Coolie Peak, and she was messing about it like she didn't know what she was doing, he reported. And then on Monday she anchored again in Grand Harbour. Wally said that the owner and his wife went up to the hotel for lunch, and then afterwards they took a taxi and went down to Frobisher Street. They spent an hour with Fred Coker in his office, and then he drove them down to Admiralty Wharf, and they went back on board Mandrake. She weighed and sailed almost immediately. Is that all? Yes, Chubby nodded, except that Fred Coker went straight up to the bank afterwards and put $1,500 in his savings account. How do you know that? My sister's third daughter works at the bank. I tried to show a cheerful face, although I felt ugly little insects crawling around in my stomach. Well, I said, no use moping around. Let's try and get the pump assembled so we can catch tomorrow's tide. Later, after we'd carried the water pump up to the caves, Chubby returned alone to the whaleboat, and when he came back, he carried a long, canvas-wrapped bundle. "What have you got there, Chubby?" I demanded. And shyly, he opened the canvas cover. It was my FN carbine, and a dozen spare magazines of ammunition, packed into a small haversack. "I thought it might come in useful," he muttered. I took the weapon down into the grove and buried it beside the cases of gelignite in a shallow grave. Its proximity gave me a little comfort when I returned to assist in assembling the water pump. We worked on into the night by the light of the gas lanterns, and it was after midnight when we carried the pump and its engine down to the whaleboat and bolted it to a makeshift mounting of heavy timber, which we placed squarely amidships. Angelo and I were still working on the pump when we ran out towards the reef in the morning. We had been on station for half an hour before we had it assembled and ready to test. Three of us dived on the wreck, Chubby, Sherry, and myself, and we manhandled the stiff black snake of the hose through the gunport and up into the breech through the well of the hold. Once it was in position, I slapped Chubby on the shoulder and pointed to the surface. He replied with a high sign and finned away, leaving Sherry and me in the passenger deck. We had planned this part of the operation carefully, and we waited impatiently while Chubby went up, decompressing on his way, and climbed into the whaleboat to prime the pump and start the motor. We knew we'd done so by the faint hum and vibration that was transmitted to us down the hose. I braced myself in the ragged entrance to the hold, and grasping the end of the hose with both hands. Sherry trained the torch beam onto the dark heap of cargo, and I swung the open end of the hose slowly over the rotted mass. I saw immediately that it was going to work. Small pieces of debris vanished miraculously into the hose, and it caused a small whirlpool as it sucked in water and floating motes of rubbish. At this depth, and with the RPM provided by the petrol engine, the pump was rated to move 30,000 gallons of water an hour, which was a considerable volume. Within seconds I had cleared the working area, and we still had good visibility. I could start probing into the heap with a jenny bar, breaking out larger pieces and pushing them back into the passage behind us. Once or twice I had to resort to the block and tackle, to clear some bulky case or object, but mostly I was able to advance with only the hose and the jenny bar. We had moved almost 50 cubic foot of cargo before it was time to ascend for a change of air bottles. We left the end of the hose firmly anchored in the passenger deck and went up to a hero's welcome. Angelo was in transports of delight, and even Chubby was smiling. The water around the whaleboat was clouded and filthy with the thick soup of rubbish we'd pumped out of the hold, and Angelo had retrieved almost a bucketful of small items that had come through the outlet of the pump and fallen into the sieve. It was a collection of buttons, nails, small ornaments from women's dresses, brass military insignia, some small copper and silver coins of the period, and odds and ends of metal and glass and bone. Even I was impatient to return to the task, and Sherry was so insistent that I had to donate my half-smoked cheroot to Chubby, and we went down again. We'd been working for 15 minutes, when I came upon the corner of an upended crate, similar to others which we'd already cleared. Although the wood was as soft as cork, the seams had been reinforced with strips of hoop iron and iron nails, so I struggled with it for some time before I prized out a plank and pushed it back between us. The next plank came free more readily, and the contents seemed to be a mattress of decomposed and matted vegetable fibre. I pulled out a large chunk of this, and it almost jammed the opening of the hose, but eventually disappeared on its way to the surface. I almost lost interest in this box and was about to begin working in another area, but Sherry showed strong signs of disapproval, shaking her head, thumping my shoulder, and refusing to direct the beam of the torch anywhere but at the unappetizing mess of fibre. Afterwards I asked her why she'd insisted, and she fluttered her eyelashes and looked important. "Female intuition, my dear. You wouldn't understand." At her urging, I once more attacked the opening in the case, but scratching smaller chunks of the fibre loose so as not to block the hose opening. I had removed about 6 inches of this material when I saw a gleam of metal in the depth of the excavation. I felt the first deep throb of certainty in my belly then, and I tore out another plank with furious impatience. It enlarged the opening, and I could work more easily. Slowly I removed the layers of compacted fibre, which I realized now must have been straw used as packing. Like a face materializing in a dream, it was revealed. The first tiny gleam opened to a golden glory of intricately worked metal, and I felt Sherry's grip on my shoulder as she crowded down close beside me. There was a snout and lips below that were drawn up in a savage snarl, revealing great golden fangs and an arched tongue. There was a broad, deep forehead as wide as my shoulders, and ears flattened down close upon the burnished skull. And there was a single, empty eye socket, set fairly in the centre of the wide brow. The lack of an eye gave the animal a blind and tragic expression, like some god maimed. I felt an almost religious awe as I stared at the huge, wonderfully fashioned tiger's head we'd exposed. Something cold and frightening slithered up my spine, and involuntarily I glanced about me into the dark and forbidding recesses of the hold, almost as if I expected the spirits of the Mogul Prince Guardians to be lurking there. Sherry squeezed my shoulder again, and I returned my attention to the golden idol. But the sense of awe was so strong upon me that I had to force myself to return to the task of clearing the package from around it. I worked very carefully, for I was fully aware that the slightest scratch or damage would greatly reduce the value and the beauty of this image. When our working time was exhausted, we drew back and stared at the exposed head and shoulders, and the torch beam was reflected from the brilliant surface in arrows of golden light that lit the whole like some holy shrine. We turned then and left it to the silence and the dark, while we went up into the sunlight. Chubby was aware immediately that something significant had happened, but he said nothing until we'd climbed aboard, and in silence shed our equipment. I lit a cheroot and drew deeply upon it, not bothering to mop the droplets of seawater that ran from my sodden hair down my cheeks. Chubby was watching me, but Sherry was withdrawn from us, wrapped in secret thoughts, turned inward upon herself. "You found it?" Chubby asked at last, and I nodded. "Yes, Chubby. It's there." I was surprised to hear that my own voice was husky and unsteady. Angelo, who had not sensed the mood, looked up quickly from where he was stacking our equipment. He opened his mouth to say something, but then slowly closed it as he became aware of the charged atmosphere. We were all silent, moved beyond speech. I had not expected it would be like this, and I looked at Sherry. She met my gaze at last, and her dark eyes were haunted. "Let's go home, Harry," she said, and I nodded at Chubby, He buoyed the hose and dropped it overboard to be retrieved on the following day. Then he threw the motors into gear and swung our bows to face the channel. Sherry moved across the whaleboat and came to sit beside me on the thwart. I placed my arm about her shoulders, but neither of us spoke until the whaleboat slid silently up onto the white beach of the island. In the sunset, Sherry and I climbed to the peak above the camp, and we sat close together, staring out across the reef, and watching the light fade on the sea and plunge the pool at Gunfire Reef into deeper shadow. "I feel guilty, in a way," Sherry whispered, "as though I've committed some dreadful sacrilege." "Yes," I agreed. "I know what you mean. That thing, it seemed to have a life of its own. It was strange that we should have exposed its head before any other part of it. And just suddenly to have that face glaring out at one." She shuddered and was silent for a few moments. "And yet, I felt also a deep satisfaction, a good sort of quiet feeling inside myself. I don't know if I can explain it properly, for the two feelings were so opposite, and yet mingled." "I understand. I had the same feelings." "What are we going to do with it, Harry? What are we going to do with that fantastic animal?" Somehow I didn't want to talk about money and buyers at that moment, which in itself was a measure of how profound was my involvement with the golden idol. "Let's go down," I suggested instead. "Angelo will be waiting dinner for us." Sitting in the firelight with a good meal filling and warming the cold, empty place in my belly, and with a mug of whiskey in one hand and a cheroot in the other, I felt at last able to tell the others about it. I explained how we had come upon it, and I described the fearsome golden head. They listened in complete and intent silence. "We've cleared the head down to the shoulder. I think that is where it ends. It's notched there, probably to fit into the next section. Tomorrow we should be able to lift it clear, but it's going to be ticklish work. We can't just haul it out with a block and tackle. It has to be protected from damage before we can move it." Chubby made a suggestion, and for a while we discussed in detail how the head should be handled to minimize the risk of damage. "We can expect that all five cases containing the treasure were loaded together. I hope to find them in the same part of the hold, probably similarly packed in wooden crates and reinforced with hoop iron." "Except for the stones," Sherry interrupted. "In the court-martial evidence, the Subadar described how they were packed in a paymaster's chest." "Ah, yes, of course," I agreed. "What would that look like?" Sherry asked. "I saw one on display in the arsenal at Copenhagen, which would probably be very similar. It's like a small iron safe, the size of a large biscuit bin." I sketched the size with the spread of my hands like a fisherman boasting of his catch. "It's ribbed with iron bands and has a locking rod and a pair of head padlocks at each corner." "It sounds formidable." "After 100-odd years in the pool, it'll probably be soft as chalk, even if it's still in one piece." "Oh, we'll find out tomorrow," Sherry announced with confidence.